Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. Check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. Farmer-owned, Vermont-grown, Sunset Lake CBD. Hey listeners, I want to tell you about Music Masters Collective, a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. These events give you the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like the Fab Four, Steve Earle, Richard Thompson, John Scofield, Nels Klein, the Milk Carton Kids, and many more. This June, join the Wait Band, featuring members of the band and the Levon Helm Band with special guests, including Jimmy Vivino, Bob Margolin, Lost Leaders, Chris O'Leary, Cindy Cashdollar, Stony Creek Band, Rob Fraboni, Larry Packer, and so many more at Camp Cripple Creek. This all-inclusive music vacation in the Catskill Mountains of upstate New York promises to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience featuring performances, workshops, jams, comfortable lodging, and superb dining. Visit campcripplecreek.com/undermine to register today. That's campcripplecreek.com/undermine.
Osiris.
Season's greetings, and by season, we mean season 4 of Undermine, which launched last fall. And look at us now. You haven't heard from us in months. It's now spring, and we're still in season 4. Not to be confused with the Four Seasons, which is a landscaping company outside Philadelphia. But our show tonight is going to focus on a winter's eve, December 30th, 1997, as we follow Phish down the funk tube to land us on the floor of Madison Square Garden for a great Phish show. It's the third night of their New Year's run, and the second of three nights at Madison Square Garden. This is Undermine. I'm your host, Tom Marshall. And instead of one co-host, I thought we'd bring on both of them and let them fight it out. The last one standing gets to come back next season by themselves for a 30-minute monologue about each show from summer 1998. And if they send me a reminder, I might even listen to a couple of them.
Well, Tom, to be fair, how many episodes of Undermine did you listen to from last season?
I probably should. Where can I find those?
I don't know. Ask RJ.
Hey guys, we've finally arrived. This is the night before the night, which, if you ask me, is actually the night in this specific case, but maybe also in most cases, it is always the night before the night, but also the night. So that's where I am.
You said maybe in all cases, and so I'm going to go with uppercase, as in the N in night should be capitalized, was when you say that this was the night. And V too probably should be capitalized. So capital T, capital N.
In any case, guys, are we here for the dad jokes or are we here to talk Phish?
Well, you know, dad jokes probably.
I guess dad jokes.
So, all right, guys, you and Benji, Tom, you and Benji were both at the show, as far as I know. Maybe you don't know,
I almost certainly was at this show.
There's something that happens later in the show that involves one of you coming on stage, and I won't spoil it by telling you which one. So Ben, Benji, your stage appearances are also
Hello Cleveland.
Really great. So I have to say, you know, if you listen to this, you know that this is an amazing show. And I mean, this is what I'm talking about in terms of a show, a huge bust out to open the first set, the first Sneak and Sally in 921 shows with a funk jam. Damn. And it just doesn't slow down. And I didn't even realize this until I looked back that this is the second rated show of all time on fish.net. Do you guys know what the first is?
1231.95
or 11.1795. 1231.95. Oh, bid Cypress
doesn't count.
Maybe it doesn't count. But this is 99. Ahead of 1231.95 on according to ratings. But we're not gonna we can't get into ratings because then we'll have to update everyone on how the Nielsen system.
And then we'll have to wonder what ours are.
Yeah, and you know we don't have enough time to explain Nielsen and how that works, which is obviously how these shows are rated. So,
exactly,
guys, tell me what you remember, if anything, about this first set, because we could talk about it all day, but unfortunately we don't have all day.
Well, RJ, I know that you love this show, and I also know that a lot of people love this show. As you just said, you know, it ranks up there. So, you know, but just like the previous two nights, this is a first set that I don't often revisit. And it's not because it's not fantastic. It absolutely is. But, you know, in 1998, when tapes of the show would have first been in circulation, you know, in the old United States Postal Service social network, sometimes you would only get one set of a show. I mean, I usually get both of them, but then the next problem is where do you listen to Fish usually? You know, for me, I listen to Fish most often in my car, right? So back then, every set was on a cassette and every cassette took up space. And so in your car, you might have, you know, like all of the second sets from this run and the third set from New Year's Eve, but none of the first. You know, you had to be more deliberate, and it was more of an effort. So I think that's why I haven't listened to this first set as often.
Tom, what were you doing during this first set, and do you have any memories of any of the music? Hey listeners, I want to tell you about one of our great partners, DistroKid. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads and artists keeping 100% of their royalties and earnings. If you're a musician and looking to get your music out there, DistroKid is the way to go. DistroKid is available for iOS and Android and is now available in Apple's App Store and the Google Play Store. More than a million artists rely on DistroKid to get their music onto Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all other major streaming services. And with DistroKid, you can upload new releases, see your financial progress, get notified when you've earned royalties, withdraw money from the app, view and share links, check your streaming stats, and a whole lot more. DistroKid has more features than any other music distributor. Check them out today. Go to distrokid.com, that's distrokid with a capital K.com/VIP/undermine for a special offer only for our listeners. That's DistroKid, capital K, .com/VIP/undermine. Thanks, DistroKid.
Well, hey, friends. My name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like the Lumineers, Andy DeFranco, Wolf Peck, Keb Moe, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask?
I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to The Show on the Road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon.
I mean, you're right. I mean, you know me, so you're asking me this out of knowledge of being on stage with me and my weird method of preparing. So I knew I had something happening early in the second set. And as you may have suspected, RJ, I was definitely thinking hard about it. And so, you know, as such, I probably spent a lot of this set in the band room preparing mentally, but also like needlessly fretting, because I just do. That's just how I prep for stage. So I can't say honestly that I remember a lot of this first set either.
Well, you know, I do love it, RJ. I said, you know, earlier, I didn't go back and listen to it often, and that's true. But this past week, going back to listen to it, I think the Sneaking Sally and the Taste right out of the gate is the segment that you probably want to take with you. And the rest of it is wonderful in the room, top shelf fish. You know, the stash is it's a great stash, but really, aren't they all? You know, it's like Wolfman's Brother. It's like every, or Bathtub Gin, they're all great. I've never heard of bad stash. Chop Dust Torture, on the other hand, is more hit or miss, depending on if they just fire it off or fire it up. You know, and Tom, you wrote those lyrics. Do you think that, you know, as we all get older, do you think that Trey will always be comfortable singing the "Can't this wait till I'm old, can I live while I'm young" part?
Yeah, how long do we have to wait until he's old, right? Yeah. I will answer that. I will answer that. But first, a quick word about set one. So I walked in the woods yesterday and listened to this whole show. I walked for a long time, 3 hours. This show is a long show. I love it. The stash, of course, is great. You're right, Benji. And the jam has this like quiet and moody thing where they're listening to each other so well. And I think Amar Sastry, who does some of the music for our show, used to do these things where he would sort of anatomy of a jam, analyze jams. And he was the one that kind of made me realize, like, when one of the band members hints at a certain other key or certain other mode of jamming. And I could hear it in this stash, and it becomes moody, and they're listening incredibly well. And then also just like the fact that Trey, all he has to do is like touch the ending note, and Mike and Paige immediately start singing the outro. And I just, it's like the kind of like the quintessential 97 heightened awareness jam mode that the band's in that I just love. But for me, it is about the Sneaking Sally, and Taste, which was still kind of new for me to see. The band was so amped about playing Sneaking Sally. It was palpable in their discussions and in their private backstage practice room, which I should have had video for. It's like one of those things I kick myself, you know, because I saw so many of these like before the big bust out practices. And so I was one of those people who didn't really know anything about this song or Robert Palmer, and I still don't. But for whatever reason, the band's excitement about it spread to the audience, and it honestly set the mood for the whole show. And Taste, by this time in late 97, I'd been listening to nonstop to the Billy Breathes version, and it was burned into my soul. And Mike, his approach for this particular song was so bizarre and different. And we temporarily lost RJ, and I hope that it's still recording. Yeah, we got him back. The recording stayed on, RJ, so I think we're okay. But like Mike's approach, you know, his role was the solid anchor that guided the song through, to me, difficult terrain, and made it sound easy and natural. But for this version, he was completely unmoored, and the band was hitting notes, and he was hitting notes, not where I felt the band or the song needed them, but instead he's kind of soloing, testing the waters, adding color. It's brilliant. And I remember actually asking him about it, maybe not this particular one, but asking him about playing Taste. And he said, there are two ways to play the bass to Taste, in sort of Mike cryptic fashion. And I guess this was way number two. I don't know. In any case, it's great. And I'm so glad I re-listened. So is Trey ever getting tired of singing "Can't This Wait Till I'm Old, Can I Live While I'm Young"? Well, no. He loves singing that. It's the payoff. It's the payoff line. And he loves Chalk Dust Torture so much. But of course, he recognizes the irony in the words as he and I and the band approach the 60 barrier. 60 years old, dudes. I can't wrap my head around it. It's happening to me very soon, a couple months. And I think Paige is about to cross that line next month, May, I think. So he's the first one of the Fish Insider gang that's going to cross that 60 line. But I'll tell you one thing. Yeah.
Tom, before you get into the end of this, which I think I know where you're going, can I just say about Taste real quick that this song, it underwent a lot of like transformations, right? It started as Fog That Surrounds, then it maybe just on tapes became Taste That Surrounds, and then it became Taste. And I feel like by 97, they like figured out the like where it fit, how it fit. And I feel like before that, it was kind of like experimenting how it fit into the live rotation. But it really like by fall 97, it just like occupied this space that I think is really kind of important. Like coming out of that Sneak and Sally, it was just a perfect landing place. And it's interesting, some of these songs, especially now in like 4.0, where there's like some of the Trey solo stuff or the stuff that you wrote with Trey, right, you know, before the pandemic, it's like kind of hard to figure out where it fits. But then you like listen to a show and you're like, oh, that now this is where it fits. I feel like that's what this Taste does for me in this set.
I love it. And we should remind people, maybe we can put in the show notes if you guys don't remember the exact one, but Benji and I last season, well, no, possibly early this season, talked about this song and how there were different lyrics and how did Fishman grab every other lyric and start saying it as part of the song.
Yeah, I don't remember the episode offhand. However, I do remember we took turns reading the lyrics and we traced the changes.
Yeah.
Yeah. We did an archaeological dig.
Yeah. So we sort of reconstructed Taste and Fog That Surrounds and how it became its current version. But go back and listen to every single thing that we've ever done and you'll find that. But I will tell you one thing. If I do have to revise any of the lines of Chalk Dust Torture at this particular moment, it might be, can't this wait till after the break? Can't I live when we come back? All right, we are back from break and I was just getting yelled at by my boss, the boss, RJ, for not knowing exactly which episode we talked about The Fog That Surrounds. I'm sorry, I do not, but we are going to put it in the show notes. I promise you that. And by we, I mean RJ. So anyway, before the break, we were talking about December 30th, 1997. And now, believe it or not, we still are, except it's the second set.
Oh my God. So guys, we just got to get straight into this AC/DC bag. So, all right. It's kind of a slow tempo to start. And then about 7 minutes into it, Trey and Mike are kind of like doing this little, you know, they're communicating. And then Paige comes in with these like instantly recognizable riffs on the keys. And maybe it's only instantly recognizable if you've listened to this 100 times like I have, but Trey starts a little like Psycho Killer tease, and thank God they didn't go into Psycho Killer, because that would have thrown, you know, that's what they did in Dayton, right? Same transition. And it would have just, the whole set would have been different. But they get into like this, you know, just kind of slowly into this kind of spacey jam. And then like 16 minutes into it, there's this like blissy arpeggios from Trey, which we know from fall 97, and then comes like the rock soloing after that, and it's an adventure. And it's probably, I think it's the third longest AC/DC bag, and to quote our friend Scott Gray on one of the best episodes of the past season, 622.94, this is the third longest if you're a size queen, which is what he called me. But I think this is one of the best, like maybe, I mean, after Hampton and maybe after the Boise 99 version. But it's interesting, Benji, like this, it's another example of a song that evolved from a rocker into a jam vehicle. And I was looking back, I wonder if this is ever going to get that kind of treatment again. So two-part question, Benji. First, what's your take on this monster? And second, will they jam AC/DC bag like this ever again?
And by this monster, he doesn't mean me. Sorry.
Well, then my take on this monster,
and
RJ,
shout out to Monster, who maybe is listening.
Yes, who may be listening.
Hey,
but
monster.
My take on this monster, RJ, is that yes, it is a monster. And I have more to say about it, as you probably guessed. But first, let me answer the second part of your question. Will they jam AC/DC bag like this ever again? You know, Lucille Bluth, Arrested Development, might say something like, you know, I don't understand the question, and I won't respond to it. Well, I do understand the question, and it's a simple question, and I am going to respond to it, but it's not a simple answer. They will never jam AC/DC bag like they did on 12/30/97 because they're not a band given to stagnation. Will they jam the song out into type 2 territory again? Certainly, and they have. Look, you know, there were type 2 show stealing AC/DC bands in 1997. There are two of them. So the first one was just a month before this one, and that was in Hampton, Virginia at the Mothership. And in fact, you know, that AC/DC bag kind of defines that run, and by extension, that tour, you know, and that the band didn't have to rely on their show horses to win that race. So, you know, 97 was one of those periodic years where they really like to drive home the fact that any song on any given night should be given, you know, the treatment. And we saw that most recently, and I think most successfully in 2021. But this AC/DC bag, I mean, in my opinion, this AC/DC bag is kind of the ultimate one, right?
Or as you might say, Benji, the penultimate one.
Well, you know, Tom, actually, factually, this is the penultimate 20-plus minute version of AC/DC bag, because 2 years after this, there was one more, and that was on 9/14/99, if I'm going to channel my inner Brian Brinkman. it's that equally legendary version from Boise, Idaho, right? 9/14/99. So I think that one is technically the longest one to date, but all three of these versions are over 20, under 30, and coincidentally or not, they're also my top three favorite versions. But this one, 12/30, it just hits differently. You know, maybe this bad is just more of my bad. I was at all three of these, and I therefore walked out of three Phish shows marveling that AC/DC bad was actually the highlight of the night. But this one, 12/30, I mean, RJ, this just gets the gold, you know, for me. It's got Chow Funk, but it also rocks and in turn rolls. You know, the reason that I said they might not ever jam out of AC/DC bad like that ever again, though, is because one, this is a Vincent Van Gogh. And if you're Vincent Van Gogh and you just painted Starry Night, you might not paint so many starry skies after that, right? And two, I hope he didn't paint a lot of starry skies after that. The other part of my point here is that when they do another 20-plus minute AC/DC badge, and they will at some point, it will sound more like the 2022 bads from Philly or Merriweather, because we're just in a different era of Phish now. You know, but I don't know. RJ, what's your take after this? They do the AC/DC badge. It segues beautifully into McGrupp, you know, which I think took us all by surprise. Then still takes me by surprise now, even listening back in the tapes, even knowing where it's going. But I think it's a great call. Do you like it here?
And wow, that's a lot to respond to. Yes. I mean, first of all, I just want to go back to the Boise. I know we're not allowed to do this on Undermine, but I'm going to do it anyway, which is the Boise 99 AC/DC bag is just, after this episode, just go back, everyone, and listen to that, because it's just phenomenal. Tom, I think when we talked about, I believe it was 11/26/97, and you loved the McGrupp. I think it was that show, or maybe it was another 97 show that you really loved the McGrupp. And that this is maybe like one of the best, just because it's a little bit different. But it works well here. I mean, I think, you know, any cool down after like a huge jam is totally fine by me. And I think McGrupp works really well here, although it is a little bit more of a spooky kind of thing. It's not a cool down like Lifeboy, you know. It's like a cool down, but also still kind of floating in outer space. So I approve of it. I think it was a nice transition, and I would gladly hear McGrupp anytime.
I'm right there with you. I don't really have a take. I mean, like I said, I kind of listened to this show with like full memory and cognition just yesterday, and the McGrupp kind of stands out. I think it did strike a memory chord, because, you know, I love the song, It's like the beginning to Gamehenge, and you never know like what's going to happen after they play McGrew up. Sometimes, you know, in the back of your head, you're thinking, what's next? This one's beautiful. And I remember just thinking about the, you know, it was really good headphones, and I was playing it, and it just was pristine, sounded beautiful. The version of the recording I had, and kind of like getting into the, I remember Trey had said that he kind of ripped off the doodly 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 from Here Comes the Sun, the Beatles. So I went back and listened to that, and of course it's right in there. Check it out. Check that out. That's my little tidbit for today.
Thank you. Your tidbits are always great, Tom. So Benji, at this point, I don't think the set's over yet. There's some stuff that happens after this, according to the set list.
Yeah, well, Tom did say that there's magic that always can happen after McGrupp, and you never quite know. And I think on this night, he probably knew what was going to happen after McGrupp. But, you know, here's the thing. We're talking about that harpua now, and I am constantly amazed at how low harpua gets ranked in some matchups, like Week in Woods bracket. You know, like, and, and granted, I understand, like, harpua and Harry Hood, they're two totally different beasts, right? But to me, harpua is one of those songs that no matter how many times I've seen it live, I'm always chasing it. I'm always hoping for it. I'm always thrilled when it happens. And the reason being is it's not the musical pinnacle of the show per se, but there's also something to be said about entertainment value, right? And to me, when they do that oompa-pa, it usually signifies something else is happening. You know, it's going to tie the night, or it's going to tie the run or something together for us. It has a purpose. And before they even get that last oompa-pa out, I'm already anticipating, you know, that there's going to be a fun moment when we find out what song Jimmy is listening to. So the purpose of this harpua on 12:30, of course, was to set up the Nets Night New Year's Eve gag, you know. But then the song that Jimmy was listening to after a Trey story that was longer than my AC/DC bag explanation earlier, it stole the entire show in terms of sheer entertainment. There was at that moment, ladies and gentlemen, when New Jersey's favorite son came out to lead a duet on a Proclaimers tune with Trey. So I don't know, Tom, whose idea was it to cover 500 miles?
I honestly think it was mine. I would always like kind of propose things to Trey songs, you know, like the Oasis song or, you know, Champagne Supernova or some other stuff. I think we both were sort of like secret pleasures of listening to pop songs. But this one, I was kind of obsessed by it because of the video I saw of those gorky Irish brothers in their glasses and their wacky accents. And I kind of sang along with it, and it was too perfect. And Trey agreed instantly.
Did you know the purpose of that harpoon that night beforehand? I mean, I guess so, when you're in the rehearsal room going through the song, right?
I don't know. No, I'm not really sure. I don't think I knew much about the gag.
Well, then this will be something you do know a little bit more about. And I'm asking here for, I guess, the Hannibal Lecter, if you will. Tell us how the Hannibal Lecter part came into it. And I would set this up for everybody listening, but everyone's heard this version. Everyone listening to this episode has definitely heard you guys seen Hannibal Lecter in the Proclaimers in 500 miles in the harpua.
So there's some wacky thing that the Irish brothers, I don't know if they're brothers actually, the Irish dudes do in harmony together. Halfway into the song, they all go ba-da-la-ba-ba or da-da-la-da-da or something like that. And while we were practicing, one of us said Hannibal Lecter instead of whatever they're actually saying. And I remember we just completely cracked up backstage. Both of us being huge Silence of the Lamb fans. And I vowed not to sing it on stage. But when I got out there and we were performing it, Trey sang it, I think, the second time. I think it was like, da-da-da-da, and he's supposed to answer me. I think he answered, without even hesitating, Hannibal Lecter. It could have been the first response or maybe the second, but it happened way sooner. I was thinking it wouldn't happen at all. But anyway, it was funny as hell. So if you see huge smiles on our face, it's not only because we're having a good time singing the song, it's because of the Hannibal Lecter joke.
Well, I'm not even sure that I picked up on it during that night until the re-listen. I honestly can't remember, but I do remember I definitely was smiling ear to ear. I mean, that was just, it was a great appearance, Tom. Oh, and also, by the way, I have to say that your accent was admirable. what was going on at the end?
Well, let's see. They just played Day in the Life. And so I decided to call out my pal, Big Phil, who was looming in my presence. He's this guy you can't miss. He's like 9 feet tall. And he's, so I said to him at the very end, I just kind of walked up to the mic and said, "I'd love to turn you on, Big Phil." And I was thinking it was something that he might say because he's always very generous with his weed. But so right at the very end, right before I said thank you and left, took my silly glasses off and threw them into the crowd. They were just the frames of cheap reading glasses and I'd punched out the lenses. So I threw them into the audience. And then in 2016, when we started Under the Scales, a few times I suddenly mentioned that I'm wondering whatever happened to those glasses anytime it came up. And can the person who caught them please identify themselves? And so at a fish show a few years ago, the magic of social media, a dude came up to me and introduced himself as the one who caught them. And he said he had tried to obtain the glasses that night to give back to me. And I said, "No, that's fine. You should keep them. You caught them." And he said, "Oh, thank God." And it turns out that he gave them to a girlfriend who is no longer a girlfriend. Well, I mean, she's no longer a friend anyway.
So Benji, what you said that Harpua, besides getting Tom on stage, there's a purpose to the narration. I mean, the narration is it's kind of fun. I mean, it's a little more cohesive than some of the narrations in that it's like an actual story that has some, or at least in theory has some rooting in reality. But you know, Lost in Space but then they get into the pentagram and
with all the food items.
Do you have a theory about this?
Yeah, Benji.
I don't have a theory about it other than I have the recollection of it where at the time it almost, you know, there is that more in more recent years, you know, we said recently we lamented the trade isn't banter the way he used to. But then there was also what am I thinking of, Audrey? The pan narration. Yes, exactly. And Zamfir is very similar to this in some ways, you know, in the same building. It was just, but I mean, at the time I think, and it's hard to, you know, without reconstructing history, it's hard to remember what I was thinking at the time, considering that it was 1997, but, you know, and just decades ago, lifetimes ago. But I do remember thinking of a part of me was like, wow, this was really last minute, wasn't it? Where they're just like, he's throwing everything out there. And it was obviously pre-planned so that there was some feeling that this was going somewhere. But then when it didn't, you know, I said earlier that harpoons have a purpose, but that wasn't always the case. For years when they played Harpua, it was just, you know, an insular story that was fun and entertaining. And then Jimmy plays like the Spin Doctors or something. And that's a cool moment because it's a cover, you know, like, or ABBA, or, you know, or whatever it is. And it's usually funny or cool, or, you know, it has entertainment value, but not the purpose. So on this night, when they played that Harpua, I wasn't necessarily thinking, oh, they're setting up, you know, the New Year's gag. Now, of course, as soon as they say Oompa-pa, that's, you're like, okay, we're going to get a clue here, you know. But so that night, it wasn't until the following night that it came, you know, became clear. However, I will say that I was on a date in New York City on New Year's Eve, so the day after this narration, and we walked by, I think the Guggenheim, and there's a storefront with a museum and a gallery storefront. And she looks up and she's, oh my God, that's the utter ball. And I looked into the window and sure enough, there was an utter ball that was, you know, a piece of art in the window. So that's my takeaway from this Harpua.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's a lot. Like this show, because the show still wasn't over yet. There's a really fun hood that kind of
devolves or dissolves, depending on your perspective, into my soul. And Sleeping Monkey and Gayuti. And I think, Benji, you mentioned on yesterday's show that this, the 12:30 show, was only slightly less time than the 12:31 show, which was three sets. And this four-song encore all segues Carini, Black Eyed Katie, back into Sneakin' Sally, into Frankenstein, with Fishman on the vacuum. I mean, this is a all-time encore here, but to kind of end an all-time show.
It is. And, you know, I think people, let's maybe do some disambiguation here. People always say it was a rumor at the time that you know, they went over the curfew and so they're going to use up that hour. And that makes a lot of sense to me. But also, you know, I know that not every, especially for indoor venues, it's oftentimes there is some rigor. Outdoor venues, you have noise ordinances. And also if it's like a state or government run, you know, venue, there's issues there as well. But oftentimes there's wiggle room for when it ends. Unless it's a union thing, which is also possible.
Yeah. I think this was less noise and more unionish. And I know they paid. And it's not so much.
They did pay.
Definitely. I mean, it's not like a fine that they had to say, well, here's, you know, $10,000 or whatever. It's more just an instantaneous overtime mode that the union, they have to pay the union an extra hour, even if they go 1 minute over. So it definitely happened. And they knew they went over, so they decided to take up almost the full hour since they were paying for it.
And then the payoff was that we got a funky dance party to end a funky dance party. You know, I'll take a Trini into Black Eyed Katie, into Sneakin' Sally, into Frankenstein encore over a Rocky Top any day.
Bite your tongue. I love Rocky Top.
I do too, but do the math though, Tom. It's four versus one.
I know. Okay, you're right. Four is bigger than one. And that's going to do it for us today. We will see you again tomorrow. Same time, same place. I should say one more thing before we go, though. Undermine is brought to you by Osiris Media. Executive producers are Tom Marshall, RJB, and Benji Eisen. Edited by Eric Limarenko. Mixed and mastered by Matt Dwyer. Production assistance from Nick Sejas. Original music by Amar Sastry. And art by Mark Dowd. Good night and have a pleasant tomorrow.
Osiris.
Hey, this is Dewey Halpas, host of Peer Pleasure on the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Join me each week as I explore another long-form conversation with one of your favorite musicians, actors, comedians, or creatives. From Chino Moreno of the Deftones, John Gorley of Portugal the Man, to Fat Mike from NoFX and Ian MacKay from Fugazi and Minor Threat, we go all over the map. From Fall Out Boy to Slayer, Peer Pleasure has it all. Check us out now on Sound Talent Media.
Hello out there!
Yes, we're out there, everyone. I'm Hal Schwartz.
And I'm Flynn McClain. Together, we host None But the Brave, a podcast dedicated to the music and career of Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce and E Street Band are on tour right now for the first time in 6 years, and we're taking a detailed look at what's happening on stage in our bi-weekly episodes.
We've also been recently joined by some very exciting guests, including rock journalist Warren Zanes and Stephen Hyden, Backstreet's Magazine founder Charles Cross, and Barstool's Kirk Menahan.
If you're a diehard Springsteen fan, this is the show for you.
So please subscribe to None But the Brave on your favorite podcasting platform, and we hope to see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much! We'll be seeing you!